down the flow of oil to the United States. This will raise the price of gas and anger the people. There will be infighting, and everyone will blame the politicians, who will become protective of their positions. There will be turmoil. It is our hope that this will cause the Americans to begin to use up their oil reserves. This will create the need to drill for oil in Alaska. The environmentalists will fight Congress for endangering protected forests and waterways. Billions of dollars will be spent in attempting to drill for oil and pipe it to refineries. We want to help break the financial back of the only nation that stands in our way of world control. Everyone clapped. John Bartholomew and Sir William Merton were calling, "Hear, hear!" "We'll then help the European Union to open liberal trade negotiations with South America, Canada, Asia, India, and the African countries," Mendes continued. "They will turn to the EU for support. Nations around the world will begin to kiss up to Europe. At the same time, we will tighten restrictions on American goods. The U.S. manufacturers will have to lay off people due to international boycotts. Unemployment demands and welfare checks will begin to drain the American coffers. Retail spending will decrease, as the unemployed have to use all of their money just to survive. More people will be laid off in a vicious cycle of no demand and no supply. The citizens will become restless and hostile toward their own democratic government. In some places, we will attempt to help create civil unrest. For example, we'll plant rumors that layoffs are being caused because of race and religious convictions. It will be chaotic."
"It sounds very good so far," Viorica Inesco said, smiling. "Now for phase four. This plan is to create medical emergencies. We are funding sleeper cells within the United States. At a given point, they will release a smallpox epidemic. This will tie up medical personnel and many dollars. Other sleeper cells will send anthrax packages to local, state, and federal government leaders, even in small to medium-sized communities. It will create pandemonium. This will tie up police, security, and emergency services all over America. More energy and money will be spent. Then, when the crisis seems to reach its peak, our remaining sleeper cells will bomb key larger hospitals. The Americans have a weakness for caring for the sick and needy. They will rally to their aid and will begin to pull in all their resources to protect their own."
"Isn't this wonderful?" Jacoba Werner said, shifting her weight in her chair and sitting forward.
"In phase five, to weaken the U.S. stock market, we will then have the Arab sheikhs begin to move their money out of the U.S. market into the European Union. This will help strengthen the euro and weaken the U.S. dollar. We will tell large foreign stockholders to buy stocks on margin and inflate the market with a false upward trend. People will invest and then will have them fail to pay on the margin, causing a drop. We will attempt to cause some quick upward and then downward moves in the market. Investors will become nervous and stop investing. After this happens several times, Americans will begin to look at investing in the more stable European markets. More money will drain out of the United States. We may not be able to collapse the market, but we can greatly weaken it."
"Very good," John Bartholomew said enthusiastically. Werner continued,
"We will infuse money into the Americans' next presidential election. Our plan is to support those candidates who are more liberal and socialistic in their thinking. Once they are in office and world political pressure mounts, they will cave in to the demands of other countries. They will want to be accepted in the global community, not hated. They will seek peace at any cost. Their independence will decrease as they conform to the flow of the coming worldwide society of men."
Everyone turned and looked at General Lee, who nodded.
"Phase six is unique. It is called the Fire Plan. With the threats of war, nuclear proliferation, terrorist bombings, boycotting of U.S. trade, the increase in oil prices, the weakening of Wall Street, and medical emergencies, all of America's resources will be stretched to a breaking point. Certain sleeper cells will then start actual fires, beginning near large metropolitan areas. The first priority in firefighting is to protect people, then structures, then forests. As the fires rage in the cities, other sleeper cells will start forest fires near power plants, in the hope of shutting down large power grids. Then they will start fires in the forests surrounding dams. The plan is to cause erosion problems, which will lead to increased runoff, mudslides, and flooding. Hopefully, this will damage crops, structures, and transportation.
Everyone nodded in agreement. The plan sounded wonderful to them.
The U.S. has already been drained financially with the war in Iraq, tornadoes, hurricanes, and flood relief in its own country. They have been helping in relief efforts in Afghanistan and Turkey, and for the tidal wave victims. The weakening of the U.S. economy will affect the entire world. It will strengthen the European economy, and that is exactly what is needed. The only way to conquer a great country like the United States is by dividing it. If we can get it to fight on many fronts, the Americans will finally give up dealing with the rest of the world and will draw in to protect their own. They will become so weak as to no longer be a threat, especially in the one place we have not yet mentioned, Israel. If we can get the U.S. to cut off aid to Israel, we can destroy and finally eliminate that canker from the face of the earth. The world will be in turmoil, and will be crying for a world leader to step in and take control.
Sir William Merton was nodding vigorously. He looked a little warm in his clerical collar.
The seventh phase is to begin the religious movement, he explained. When the world is in a desperate financial condition, the people will turn to religion for support. Remember, religion is the opiate of the masses. We will begin funding various religious leaders and also begin to call for all faiths to unite. We will push for the universal brotherhood of man. We will support and encourage the homosexual community. Those who oppose them will be ridiculed, threatened, and punished. We can do this by instituting legislation that will take away critical tax advantages for churches and religious organizations. Any who oppose our plan can be accused of hate speech and jailed for nonconformity. That will squelch any opposition. We'll establish a new world religion that will have vast influence over the people.
His eyes glowed as he spoke. John Bartholomew cleared his throat and spoke.
Some parts of these plans are already in place and operating effectively. The rest will come into being soon. So far, our plan is coming together. If Talon can carry out his assignments, I believe we will be right on schedule. I think this calls for a toast.
Chapter 31 Murphy looked up at Isis as she read, studying her for a moment. There was no question that she was beautiful. Her sparkling green eyes and red hair were striking, but there was more. She was smart, well-read, and could hold her own in almost any conversation. She was fun to be with, and was not afraid to try things that were new and different. She was independent, and yet at the same time seemed to need his strength. He felt a strong desire to protect her. He knew that he was beginning to recover from Laura's death. He could sense a new love growing, and it felt comfortable and good. Isis looked up, and their eyes met. She smiled, and he fought the urge to reach out and embrace her. After a moment, she lowered her eyes and began to read again. Murphy took a deep breath and opened a new folder. As he picked the folder up, he noticed something about the journal he had just placed on the table. A piece of paper seemed to be sticking out in back. Murphy picked up the journal again and pulled what turned out to be two pages together. On one was a genealogy of the child Dr. Anderson and his partner had helped to create. Traceable genealogy of the boy, Harley B. Anderson, M.D., Transylvania, Romania, October, 1963. Zigana Averna, great-grandmother of Karis Mazikeen. Mariana Yakov, grandmother of Karis Mazikeen. Karis Mazikeen, egg provider for the boy. Alfred Meinrod, sperm provider for the boy. Carmine Anguis, father of Kalinda Anguis, the inseminated mother who bore the boy. Kala Matrinka, mother of Kalinda Anguis, the inseminated mother who bore the boy. Kalinda Anguis, birth mother of the boy. The boy.
"Look at these," Murphy exclaimed.
"It seems that Dr. Anderson has done some of the work for us already. Let's see what we can find out about these people."
Murphy continued, "Anderson writes that Carmine Anguis, the father of the birth mother, was a gypsy chieftain from the Rom tribe. They are well known for fortune-telling. I've heard that some of their members built homes that looked like churches. They would then beg on the street by showing them pictures of the outside of what looked like a cathedral. They would ask them to help build their church. It was really their home. That scam is still happening today. I've seen many of those types of homes in Romania."
"It sounds like a play on people's emotions. Does it say anything about the mother, Kala Matrinka?"
"Dr. Anderson suggests that she may have been a prostitute before becoming Carmine's wife."
"What about Alfred Meinrod?"
"He was a scientist and had a Ph.D. in astrophysics and a second Ph.D. in microbiology. He was a very outspoken atheist and evolutionist. I don't believe he ever married. According to newspaper reports, he was killed in a mysterious automobile accident. He was driving in the mountains when all of a sudden he veered off the road and down into a canyon. Does that scenario sound familiar?"
"That's just what happened to Dr. Talpish," Isis exclaimed thoughtfully. "Michael, you asked me how Madame Blavatsky, Annie Besant, and Alison Bailey tied together with Dr. Anderson. I think I found it. Look at the genealogy of the boy. Zigana Averna was the great-grandmother of Keris Mazikeen. Zigana worked as an assistant for all three of the women, first for Blavatsky, then Besant, and finally Bailey. She died sometime in the early 1940s. She was the mother of an illegitimate child named Mariana Yakov. The father's name was Ivan Yakov from Stalingrad. Ivan Yakov was later imprisoned for murder. Mariana Yakov became a prostitute until her mid-30s, when she married Aaron Mazikeen. Dr. Anderson indicated that he was a drug smuggler and was shot to death in Istanbul. Mariana Yakov gave birth to a girl named Keris Mazikeen. Later, Yakov, an alcoholic, died. Mazikeen provided the egg for the boy. Alfred Meinrod provided the sperm. Kalinda Anguis was merely the host body that gave birth to the fertilized egg."
"Wow," said Murphy. "Dr. Anderson really had to do some investigating to discover all that."
"Yes," Isis agreed. "He goes on to say that Zigana was an expert in table rapping, seances, fortune-telling, and channeling of spirits. She even exceeded Blavatsky in her ability to do signs and wonders. She became a devil worshipper and excelled in corruption of every sort."
"I don't think I would want her babysitting the grandchildren."
"Michael, Michael, listen," Isis exclaimed, reviewing the genealogy. "You know that I can read and speak many languages."
"Sure, I know that."
"Look at these names. Zigana Averna. Zigana is Hungarian for gypsy. And Averna is Latin for queen of the underworld. Mariana Yakov. Mariana is Russian for rebellious. And Yakov is Russian for supplanter, one who takes the place of another. Keris Mazikeen. Keris is Greek for evil spirits, and Mazikeen is Jewish for elf-like beings that can change shapes. Alfred Meinrod. Alfred is Italian for counselor to the elves, and Meinrod is German for strong advisor. Carmine Anguis. Carmine is Latin for crimson, and Anguis is Latin for dragon. Kala Matrinka. Kala is Egyptian for black, and Matrinka is Egyptian for divine mother. And finally, Kalinda Anguis. Kalinda is Latin for fiery, and Anguis is Latin for dragon. There's something really spooky about all of this, Isis said softly. Michael, what do you think the other piece of paper means?
Murphy looked at the page headed New Age Movement. New Age Movement. Many different cults, Theosophical Society, Freemasons, Illuminati, Rosicrucians, Knights Templar, Gnosticism, Kabbalism, Ancient Mystery Religions, Nimrod, the Tower of Babel. My guess is that Dr. Anderson did some further investigation, he said thoughtfully. In the Bible, Nimrod was considered the father of all cults against God. He is given credit for instigating the Tower of Babel as a rebellion to God. The various ancient mystery religions came from him. Those gave rise to Kabbalism, something you're hearing about in the news today, Gnosticism, and then the secret societies like Knights Templar, Rosicrucians, Freemasons, and the Illuminati. Anderson must have started with Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society and traced its origins back to Nimrod. No wonder he was feeling guilty and wanted to rectify his errors.
It sort of sounds like the story of Judas and how he felt remorse for being a traitor to Christ.
See, I do know a little about the Bible, Isis said with a smile. You're right, Isis. It reminds me of a short poem. Still as of old, men by themselves are priced. For 30 pieces, Judas sold himself, not Christ.
Michael, this is becoming very scary.
Chapter 32. Rashad entered the great hall and paused for a moment as he stroked his beard. A thorough search of so large a building would take some time. He walked over to the card catalog and pretended to be looking up something. A few minutes later, Asim strolled through the doors. He went to the magazine rack, selected one, and then sat down at an empty table. He opened the magazine and held it as if reading. However, his eyes were not focused on the pages. He was looking beyond. The next to enter was Fadil. No casual observer would have paid any attention to the first two Arabs. They acted quite normal. Fadil, on the other hand, stood out. Not his tall, thin body, but his nervous mannerisms. He seemed anxious, and his body made quick, jerking movements. His eyes darted back and forth, and perspiration sheened on his forehead and stained his shirt. He made his way to a bookcase and quickly pulled down a book. He didn't even look at it. He just held it as his eyes searched the room. Alvina Smith was deeply engrossed in looking up the difference between quiddity and quidnunc in the dictionary when she heard a voice.
"Excuse me, madame. But could you assist me?"
At the sound of the voice, her eyes brightened. She looked into the face of a light-skinned man with a neatly trimmed mustache, wearing a top coat and gloves. He was tall and wiry-looking. His emotionless eyes were the type that would make most people shiver, but not Alvina Smith.
"Don't say another word," she exclaimed. "Let me guess. You're from Cape Town, and you speak Afrikaans."
"You are correct," Talent said, surprised.
"How did you know that?"
Smith took off her glasses and stood up. She adjusted her blue polka-dot dress and approached the counter, smiling broadly.
"I knew it. I just knew it. I was born and raised in Cape Town myself. My parents came from a line of Dutch traders that go back to the 1700s. I can always tell someone who is from South Africa. I guess it's the combination of English and Dutch tones in their voice. At home, my parents only spoke Afrikaans, and your voice is much like my father's. It is so good to hear someone from home. I moved to the States after college and have been here ever since."
"That is all very nice, but I was wondering if you could help me."
"Oh, yes, I'd be glad to. Are you needing to look up some book or article? You look like the type of man who loves to read. I bet that you love the classics, don't you? I like classical music. It's so stimulating. Do you..."
He interrupted. "I'm looking for some friends of mine, a man and a woman. They are..."
"Are they from South Africa, too? I'd love to meet them. I wonder if they might know any of my family."
"No, they're not from South Africa," he said firmly. "The man is about my height, 6'3", rugged-looking. The woman is a redhead. Have they been in here?
Oh, yes. Who could miss that beautiful woman with the red hair? She looked like a model. Is she a model?
And the man with her was so handsome.
They made such a striking couple.
I thought to myself, now there's a happy couple.
I wonder how many children they have.
I just love children, don't you?
Are they still here? He said through gritted teeth.
I don't know, but if they are, bring them back to the counter. I'd love to meet them.
I appreciate your assistance. You're quite solicitous.
Smith smiled and blushed at the same time. It was not often that she met someone who was polite and knew how to use the English language. Most people would have only said, "Thanks for your help." That was okay, but it was so common. She watched him walk away.
It's such a joy to have a conversation with someone who is educated, and from South Africa, too.
She continued to watch him as he went over to the short man with the dark mustache at the card catalog. Two other Arab-looking men joined them.
He must be a diplomat or something. I wonder if he speaks Arabic also.
Smith was about to put her glasses back on when she saw the man look back at her, smiling and nodding. She flushed. He was not only educated, he was good-looking, too, and she had been lonely for quite some time.
"Michael, I'll be back in a moment," Isis said, rising. "I need to use the ladies' room."
As he watched Isis walk away, Murphy realized that Dr. Anderson's notes might help them discover more clues as to who the Antichrist might be. He knew that if what they were reading was true, they probably were in real danger.
"Whoever the friends of the New World Order are, it's certain that they are powerful and have an evil plan. They succeeded in killing Dr. Anderson. Will we be next?" Murphy wondered.
Smiling to herself, Isis turned and looked back at Murphy as she walked off in search of the restroom.
"When he's focused on something, it would take an earthquake to get his attention."
After passing row after row of bookshelves, she found a sign saying that the restroom was on the second floor. She did not look down into the great hall as she descended one flight. She didn't see the Arabs talking, nor did she notice Talon.
"Rashad, you and Fadil search the right side of the main floor. Asim and I will search the left side. If you find them, do not approach. Pretend that you are just ordinary people in the library. One of you stay in the area and the other come and get me. We will move up one floor at a time. Asim and I will use the elevator as we go up. You two use the stairs. That way they will not get by us."
Talon was about to continue when Asim interrupted. "Can we not kill them? I want to avenge the death of Ibrahim."
"They will die, but we must be careful. This is a public place, and we don't want people to identify us. I know you want them dead, but there is more at stake here than just the lives of two people. We don't want their deaths to jeopardize our opportunity to kill thousands."
Chapter 33. Sherry was sipping a cup of coffee at a table near the student center when Paul Wallach walked up. He wasn't quite sure how to begin. He and Sherry hadn't seen each other for about a week, and their last conversation did not end well.
"Hi, Paul. Thank you for coming. Do you want to get something to drink?"
"No, I think I'll pass. I just had lunch a little while ago. How have you been?"
Sherry paused for a moment.
"Not very good," she said truthfully. "I've been crying a lot, Paul, and I finally realized I can't go on feeling this way."
Wallach didn't say a thing. This conversation was going somewhere he really didn't want to go.
"Paul," Sherry continued, "do you remember when we used to have discussions about religion?"
"Before the bombing?"
"Yes. At that time, you seemed quite interested in looking into the Christian faith. And even after the bombing, when I visited you in the hospital and took care of you after you got out, you were interested. But now something's changed. You don't seem to want that to be part of your life."
"I guess it's just not what I thought it would be. I'm finding that my interests are changing," Wallach said quickly.
"Changing?"
"Yeah, I'm focusing my energies on the future," he explained. "It seems to charge my batteries more than church. Don't get me wrong. Church is fine for some people, like yourself, but it's just not my thing."
"What is your thing, Paul?"
Wallach began to feel a little uncomfortable. He hadn't really had to put his thoughts into words before.
I mean, I want to get out of school and get started in the business world.
With Barrington Network News?
Yes, media is an exciting field.
I think that you may be getting a wrong picture about that world. Barrington's company produces a lot of sleazy programs on television and radio. They go against the moral fabric of society. How can you be a part of that?
Barrington also does a lot of good. There are many positive, uplifting programs, Wallach countered.
Paul, you know that I've always been honest with you and with my feelings. I think that you're being used.
Wallach bristled and began to get defensive.
No one is using me, he exclaimed.
Do you think that all the whining and dining and trips to New York and Shane Barrington's jet are because he has a personal interest in you?
Yes, I do think so. He lost his son and has sort of adopted me in his place.
I know that he's paying your tuition and has promised you a job after you graduate.
Right, and he also pays me for articles that I send in to him.
Does he print the articles?
No.
What are they about?
They're about what I learn in Dr. Murphy's classes.
And why is Barrington asking you to write them?
He says that he wants to evaluate my writing style so he can place me in the proper department after I graduate.
I think something else is going on, Sherry said firmly.
What do you mean? Wallach responded, annoyed.
Why would a billionaire who's known to be an egomaniac suddenly pay the tuition of a college student he never met before? And why would he pay him money to write articles he doesn't print, about archaeology of all things? He doesn't ask to see your writing style on other topics, Paul, does he? Only on what transpires in Dr. Murphy's class? I think he's hiring you to be his personal spy.
You're just angry because I sometimes challenge your precious Dr. Murphy in class. Not everyone believes in creation, you know, Wallach said angrily.
It's not that at all, Paul. I'm concerned with your values in life. God doesn't seem to be high on your list. Money, power, and pride seem to be your focus. Those things can be very attractive at first, but in the long run they destroy a person. They don't bring true satisfaction. Jesus said, "And how do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul in the process? Is anything worth more than your soul?"
My soul is fine, thank you. I just want to get out of school and start earning some money.
Why, Paul?
That's a crazy question, Sherry, Wallach answered, exasperated. I want money so I can buy things.
Things?
Yeah, like a car, a house, a boat, or a plasma television. Things.
Then what?
What do you mean?
Well, after you buy all the things, then what are you going to do?
Have fun.
Let me see if I understand, Sherry said slowly. A job earns you money so you can buy things, so you can have some fun, right?
Right.
Paul, things don't bring lasting happiness. A car can wear out. A house can burn down. A boat can sink. And a plasma television can break. When that happens, where will your fun be?
Everyone has to earn money to live.
I don't disagree with working to provide for one's family. But in all of our conversations, you haven't talked about family, or service to the community, or contributing to the nation, or raising children with values that you can pass on. And most of all, you haven't included God in any of the scenarios you've shared with me. Most of your conversations have been self-centered and me-focused. You don't talk about helping others.
Wallach was silent. He didn't quite know how to respond. In his heart of hearts, he recognized that Sherry had accurately described his mindset.
Paul, there is something in the book of 2 Corinthians I'd like you to think about. It says, "Do not try to work together as equals with unbelievers, for it cannot be done. How can right and wrong be partners? How can light and darkness live together? How can Christ and the devil agree? What does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? How can God's temple come to terms with pagan idols? For we are the temple of the living God."
Wallach paused for a moment, trying to process what Sherry had just said.
"Are you saying that I'm in darkness and on the devil's side?" he asked angrily.
"Let me try to explain. You and I think differently about God, eternal values, how to conduct one's life,
and what's important in life. It's like water and oil. They can't be mixed together. Try as hard as I would like to. It's just not going to happen. If we were to continue our relationship, you wouldn't be happy with me, and I wouldn't be happy with you.
Sherry's eyes were beginning to well up with tears.
I think it's best if we break off seeing each other, she continued. It's evident that you and I are walking down separate roads. I can't reject all that I believe in and hold dear, no matter how much I care for you. Trying to do so will only end in disaster. I wish it didn't have to end this way, but in the long run, it will be the best for both of us.
Sherry rose and turned away as she finished her sentence. Tears were pouring down her cheeks. Chapter 34. When Isis came out of the restroom, she had no idea that Rashad and Fadil had already made it to the second floor. They were slowly walking down one end of the bookshelves, stopping at each aisle to see who might be standing there. Fadil was a half-step behind Rashad. Perspiring more than ever, he kept having to wipe his brow. An accountant by trade, Fadil had only recently been recruited to join one of the sleeper cells. He wanted to help the cause, but he had not been trained to fight and kill like the others. This was all new to him, and he was terrified. He kept thinking about his wife and children at home. What would become of them if he did not return, or if he was caught and imprisoned? Would his family be put into prison also? With thoughts like these whirling through his mind, he had a hard time concentrating on the task at hand. Isis reached into her pocket and pulled out a piece of paper. On it were her notes from the card catalog earlier in the morning. The Secret Doctrine by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. Born 1831, died 1891. Second floor, B section, number B12743, HP142. She began looking for the B section, focusing on the numbers. She couldn't wait to see what Blavatsky had written. The woman sounded fascinating. Isis stopped at the end of two rows of shelves and looked up at their numbers. She then checked her paper again. This is it. Just as Isis had stopped to look at the shelves' numbers, Rashad and Fadil were at the other end of the aisle looking down. They didn't see her because the shelves blocked her from their view. They continued in the opposite direction as she started looking on the shelves for Blavatsky's book. After she had found it, Isis headed toward the stairs. At the same moment, Rashad and Fadil entered an aisle far behind her. Isis had already opened the book and was reading it as she walked slowly up the marble stairs. Talon and Asim, on the other side of the library, peering among the shelves, did not see her. As Isis reached the third floor, she turned and looked down into the great hall. She paused for a moment to admire the beauty of the old building and the chandeliers. She was about to turn into the aisle and go back to where Murphy was studying when she saw him. Talon! Terror overwhelmed her. Instinctively, she drew back into one of the aisles. Adrenaline surged through her body, her heart raced, and she began breathing heavily. Her mind flashed back to when she had seen Talon on the back of the ship on the Black Sea. She had been certain he would kill her. Then Murphy arrived, and Talon and the brass plates went into the ocean. But how did he find them here? And who was with him? Isis watched as Talon nodded and entered the elevator. She could see the old golden arrow above the elevator door begin to rise to the third floor. As she started to turn toward Murphy, she saw two men starting up the marble stairs. They, too, looked like Arabs. Could they be here with Talon? Was it they whom he had nodded at? A surge of panic threatened to overwhelm her. Isis knew that the two men coming up the stairs would not see Murphy immediately. Their table was in a far corner, blocked by bookshelves running the opposite direction. She moved as quietly as she could toward Murphy, and then she heard voices. She quickly turned and stood at the end of an aisle and froze, her heart in her throat. The men were speaking in Arabic. She could understand the dialect.
They may have already left the library.
That may be, but we have found out which hotel they are staying at. It's only a matter of time.
Their voices trailed off as if they were moving farther away. Isis knew that they would soon go farther down the aisle and find Murphy.
She also knew that she must not make any sound that could attract their attention. She worked her way down the aisle to a place where she could see Murphy. How could she get his attention without moving closer or having him speak? Isis opened Madame Blavatsky's book and tore out the blank first page. On it she wrote one word, Talon. She then folded the paper like an airplane and tossed it at Murphy. Murphy was deeply engrossed in Dr. Anderson's journal again when he sensed a slight movement of air and saw a paper airplane glide onto the table. He looked up, only to see Isis standing in an aisle some distance from him, eyes wide in terror. She had one finger over her lips. With her other hand, she was pointing at the paper airplane. Murphy knew something was terribly wrong. After unfolding the paper and reading it, he started and half rose. He glanced quickly at Isis. She still had her finger over her lips, but was now motioning for him to come toward her. He left the table, stuffing his research notes into his pocket, and tiptoed over to her. She fell into his arms, shaking. She put her hand over his mouth as he began to speak. Quietly, she led him down the aisle to the end, where she carefully looked around the corner. She could not see either of the Arab men. They must have gone down an aisle. That meant that soon they'd be working their way back toward them. Isis grabbed Murphy's hand and led him toward the marble staircase. After glancing around cautiously, they hurried up the stairs to the fourth floor. They had to find a way to escape. Chapter 35. After reaching the fourth floor, Isis and Murphy quickly disappeared into the bookshelves.
"Michael, I'm so scared. There are at least four of them," Isis whispered.
"Tell me what you saw."
Isis explained her first sighting of Talon and the Arab entering the elevator, and the conversation she overheard in Arabic.
"They'll be up here soon, Michael. What are we going to do?"
"I don't know. Let me look around."
Murphy only had a few moments to scout around before Isis whispered,
"I see them coming up the stairs."
"Come back here where the two directions of bookshelves converge. I don't think they'll see us immediately."
Rashad and Fadil split up after reaching the top of the stairs. Rashad started down the bookshelves that were close to the railing overlooking the great hall. Fadil turned down an aisle and started toward Murphy and Isis. Murphy whispered, "When he gets near, step into the aisle and say something to him in Arabic." Then Murphy disappeared. Fadil was caught completely off guard as he approached the end of the aisle. All of a sudden, a beautiful woman with red hair stepped in front of him, took a sexy pose, and smiled.
"My, but you are handsome," she murmured. "I'll bet all of the women want to go out with you."
She was close, she was extremely attractive, and she was speaking in Arabic. Fadil did not know how to respond. He had been told not to make contact, only to find out where Murphy and Isis were. He didn't know what to do. He hadn't been trained. Should he grab her? Should he yell? Should he pretend that she was a stranger? As he turned to walk away, he didn't hear Murphy coming. Murphy fired a quick reverse punch to the Arab's sternum. The surprise and pain took his breath away, and he staggered backward. Fadil's eyes were wide with shock when Murphy struck his temple with an open palm heel strike. He immediately collapsed to the floor, unconscious. Murphy dragged his body over to a table. He placed Fadil in a chair and made him lie forward, as if he had fallen asleep while reading a book.
"That will take care of him. Quick, come with me. I found a ladder that leads through a crawl hole to the roof. It will take them a little while to figure out where we went."
On the roof, Murphy found a fire escape that ran down the side of the building.
"Most likely they'll think we went down the fire escape to the alley and they'll try to follow us. I've got a better idea."
Isis followed him to a small building that covered the elevator shaft. He pried open the door and looked down.
"There's a ladder that goes down the shaft," Murphy explained. "We'll climb down and try to get onto the top of the elevator. Maybe we can ride it to the first floor, then get in and get off in the main lobby where there are lots of people. We might be able to get lost in the crowd."
It didn't take Rashad very long to find Fadil. At first, he thought he was dead, but then could feel a heartbeat. He ran down the aisle toward the great hall. Looking around, he spied Talon and Asim on the fourth floor on the left side of the library. He gave a short, shrill whistle and waved. The other two men came running. Rashad explained about Fadil and said,
"I have looked around. I think they must have gone up the ladder in the corner to the roof." "Good work," said Talon. "Asim and I will go to the roof. You go down the stairs to the first floor. They may still be hiding in the building."
Mandy and Scott Willard and their grandmother had just gotten on the elevator on the third floor. They had been to the children's area, and each was holding several books. As they pushed the button for the first floor, they heard a thud on the top of the elevator. They all looked up. To their surprise, a hole in the top of the elevator popped open. They could see the face of a man peering down. The grandmother gasped as the children looked on wide-eyed. Murphy dropped into the elevator and smiled.
"How are you folks today?"
Murphy then raised his arms upward, and down through the hole came Isis. She shook her head and ran her fingers through her hair, fluffing it. "Hello," she said with a smile.
"Who are you?"
the boy asked in surprise. Murphy leaned forward and put his finger to his lips.
"Shh. Can you keep a secret?"
Both children nodded. The grandmother just stood there with her mouth open.
"We're detectives trying to find some top-secret information. Some evil men are after us."
"Cool," said the boy.
"Can you promise not to let them know that we were here?"
Both children nodded vigorously.
"Now raise your hand and say, 'I promise to keep the secret from the evil men,'" Murphy said seriously.
"I promise," both said as they raised their free hands.
By then, the doors opened at the first floor and Murphy and Isis exited the elevator. The two children waved goodbye, and the grandmother was still looking on in shocked silence. They were almost to the front door when Rashad saw them. He ran across the great hall, shoving chairs aside to clear his path. Alvina Smith's head jerked up at the commotion.
"There's no running in the library," she called out in a loud whisper. "You must be quiet."
Rashad didn't even hear her. And if he had, it wouldn't have made a difference. He couldn't let them get away. Isis had seen the man start to run as they were exiting the front door.
"Michael, one of them has seen us."
Murphy grabbed her hand and they ran across the busy street, dodging cars, around the building, and into the alley. Murphy had Isis hide behind a dumpster. He grabbed one of the bottles littering the ground and hid behind some boxes. Rashad could see no movement in the long alley. He drew his gun and moved forward cautiously, looking left and right. After Rashad had just passed the boxes, Murphy threw the bottle. It crashed on the wall on the opposite side of the alley, and instinctively, Rashad turned toward the sound and fired. That was Murphy's opportunity. Rushing forward, he hit the Arab from behind. The impact sent the gun flying out of his hand and Rashad to the ground. Recovering quickly, he rolled and jumped to his feet. Murphy could tell that he was facing a trained fighter. They began to circle, sizing each other up. Then the Arab rushed in, ducking, and took out Murphy's feet with a leg sweep. Murphy crashed to the concrete, onto his elbow. Murphy rolled and sprang to his feet, only to receive a side kick to the stomach. He fell backward in pain. He flashed to the face of Terence Lee, a young Cantonese archaeology student who had taught Murphy the secret of drunken man fighting.
"Professor Murphy, when a drunken man falls, he is soft like a rag. He does not hurt himself. When he stands up, he is hard to hit, like a sapling swaying in the wind. And when he strikes, no one expects it."
Murphy began to stagger, as if he had been seriously injured by the kick. He looked like he would fall over at any second. Rashad smiled and went in for the kill. He was going to use a tiger claw strike to Murphy's throat and break his larynx. Murphy's head was drooping. He looked too injured even to lift his head. Rashad lunged with his right arm outstretched. As he moved forward, Murphy glided slightly to the right and planted his foot. At the same time, he drove his right fist around, top center knuckle leading, into the left side of Rashad's neck, just under the jawbone. Instantly paralyzed, the Arab dropped to the ground in a heap. Murphy bent over and looked at him.
That will probably take him about 2 months to get over, he thought grimly.
Murphy and Isis straightened their clothing and hid out in the back of a busy coffee shop for 3 hours before returning to the library. They needed to retrieve Dr. Anderson's folders and journal, but they wanted to be sure the coast was clear. They entered the library carefully, looking all around for Talon and his associates. Seeing none of them, they climbed to the third floor and went back to the table where they had been working. The table was empty, and Murphy's briefcase was gone.
"Do you suppose the library staff picked it up, Michael?" Isis asked, a hopeful note in her voice.
"I certainly hope so. I don't like the alternative."
Alvina Smith was studying the difference between primogenitor and primogeniture when Murphy and Isis approached the front desk.
"Excuse me," Murphy said. "We happened to leave some papers on a desk on the third floor. Would any of the library staff have picked them up?"
Smith looked at Murphy and Isis and smiled.
"Why, I'll bet you're the people the gentleman from South Africa was looking for. How did you meet him? Did you go to school in South Africa?"
"South Africa?"
"Oh, yes. The moment I met your friend, I could tell he was from South Africa. I guessed that he spoke Afrikaans, and he said I was right. He was well-spoken and quite educated. And he had—"
"Excuse me," Murphy interrupted, "about the papers?"
"Oh, yes. Your friend picked them up for you. He said you forgot your briefcase and he would take it to you. He was such a nice man. Very soft-spoken and polite. He left about 3 hours ago. Is there anything else I can help you with?"
"No, thank you," Murphy replied, turning from the desk.
Murphy and Isis paused on the steps of the library.
"There goes all of our clues about the Antichrist," he said in a dejected tone.
Isis didn't say anything. Nothing she could say would bring back Dr. Anderson's notes. Murphy brushed his fingers through his hair.
"South Africa," he murmured. "That's interesting. At least we learned something new about Talon. He's from South Africa and he speaks Afrikaans. That may give us a way to track down more information about him."
Isis could see Murphy's expression change as he looked into her eyes.
"I'm glad you're safe," he said soberly.
Chapter 36. The Night of the Attack, Babylon, 539 BC. Suleiman slowly climbed the long stairway up to the king's banquet hall. The night was warm and the moon was full. Torches lined both sides of the stairs, and it was easy to see. The smell of jasmine was in the air. He was looking for and alert to any danger that might be lurking in the shadows. As he glanced around, he did not see any danger, only laughing couples half-drunk with wine and groping each other. As captain of the king's royal guard, it was his job to ensure that his men were on duty and not swept up in the debauchery of the evening. It was difficult for young soldiers to stand by watching others indulging themselves and keep their minds on the task of protecting the king and his nobles. This was not the first time that King Belshazzar had invited his friends to a night of revelry. In fact, these parties were becoming more and more frequent. This was, however, the largest one Suleiman had seen. The wine was flowing freely among the thousand guests. And tonight the celebration wasn't restricted to the palace. All of Babylon was caught up in the excitement.
"General Azam," young Captain Hakim said, saluting, "do you have any more men you can spare? General Jawar is pleading for help. He says that we must get the trench dug within the hour. He thinks that he will be able to breach the Euphrates into the marsh above the city. They have about 30 cubits to go."
"Tell him I can give him 2,000.
He signaled his aide, gave him the order, and sent the captain running into the night. General Jawar, pleased with the reinforcements, sent a message back to General Azam.
The soldiers would be readied. As soon as the water was drained from the moat, a detachment would be sent under the wall. According to the two deserters, Gobryas and Gadatas, there was a secret way into Babylon. Once the troops got in, they would open the main gate and let in the rest of the army. As Suleiman entered the great hall, one of the royal guards came running to him.
"Sir, the king is calling for you."
Suleiman ran to find the king.
"I just had a great idea," the king exclaimed. "I remember as a small child that King Nebuchadnezzar took me into the temple treasury of Marduk. He showed magnificent treasures captured in battle, many gold and silver cups taken from the temple of Jehovah in Jerusalem. Go down to the treasury and bring all of the cups to the great hall. I want to serve my guests in those beautiful goblets."
"Yes, O king," Suleiman said, bowing and turning to leave. Within 15 minutes he had returned, with servants carrying armloads of gold and silver cups. Soon they were cleaned and filled with wine. The glittering goblets were passed out to the princes and their wives and concubines. They drunkenly toasted each other and their idols. Their laughter became louder and their toasts more coarse. Suddenly, a loud scream was heard over the din in the great hall. Everyone turned and looked. Those closest to one side of the great hall could see the fingers of a man's hand writing on the plaster wall. There was no arm or body, just the hand and fingers. Belshazzar pushed forward so he could see clearly. At the sight of the hand and fingers moving of their own volition, the blood drained from his face. Terrified, he collapsed to the floor, shouting,
"Call the magicians! Bring the astrologers! Gather the soothsayers and sorcerers! Get the Chaldeans! Find anyone who can read the handwriting on the wall! I will make the man who can read it the third most powerful ruler in the kingdom. I will dress him in a purple robe and give him royal honor. I will put a gold chain around his neck. I need to know what it says."
Women ran screaming from the hall, followed by their husbands or lovers. Suleiman and the royal guards, their swords drawn, were prepared for battle. They were forming ranks to protect the king. The terror on their ruler's face unnerved the officers and nobles. Soon the sounds of yelling and screaming reached the queen mother in her chambers. She rushed to the banquet hall to find the king curled up in a fetal position, sobbing.
"Calm yourself, your majesty," she said firmly, pulling Belshazzar into a sitting position. "There is a man in your kingdom who has within him the spirit of the holy gods. During your father's reign, this Daniel was found to be as full of wisdom and understanding as a god himself. He was made chief of all the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers of Babylon. Daniel can interpret dreams and explain riddles. He will tell you what the writing means."
Chapter 37. Abrams discovered that it was not easy to get to Presidio, Texas. First, he had to fly to Dallas, then he took a commuter plane to El Paso, where he rented a car. The 250-mile drive from El Paso took him southeast, paralleling the Rio Grande, until he reached Esperanza, and then east to Van Horn, where he entered the low, rolling Sierra Viejas. At Marfa, he turned south and drove another 50 miles, to the sleepy little town of Presidio on the edge of the Rio Grande. Across the river was the Mexican border town of Ojinaga. After stopping for gas and directions, Abrams drove through the main business area to a very poor section of the small town. It didn't take him long to find the run-down Pancho Villa Motel. It was surrounded by boarded-up businesses, broken-down homes, and small wooden shacks. He glanced around to see if anyone was watching. The street had little traffic, and no one was out walking during siesta time. Only two beat-up cars were parked in the motel's lot. He parked, walked to the door of room 17, and knocked. The curtain on the window moved slightly, and then he heard the click of the lock.
A big man with long, curly black hair and a full beard opened the door. He had on a dirty T-shirt, exposing muscular arms, and he wore faded and ripped jeans. His sparkling brown eyes didn't fit his worn-out clothing.
Levy, it's so good to see you again. Come in, quickly.
Abrams entered the room and closed the door behind him.
That's some disguise, David, he said, grinning. Even your wife and children wouldn't recognize you.
Levy, I'm glad they sent you. This stakeout has been boring.
Aren't they all?
True. I've been living in this mansion for about 20 days. During the daytime, I walk about with a gunny sack picking up cans and bottles. The locals think I'm just another wanderer trying to make a few pennies like they do. Then, I saw 4 Arabs move into one of the old sheds down by the river. It doesn't even have any running water. Just an outhouse behind the shed. They must have crossed the border during the night. They have been very low profile, keeping to themselves and going out only for food. Outwardly, they look poor and ragged like everyone else, until they pull out their cell phones.
Have you learned anything else?
2 days ago, I followed 2 of them. They went to a used car lot in town and bought 2 old vans. I was watching from a distance. I could see them pull out a wad of cash to pay the dealer. I called the office then. I think they're getting ready to move.
I've been given the green light to put the pressure on, Abrams said. Somehow we have to get more information. Is there a way we can get one of them alone?
I think so, David replied. Each day around 8 o'clock when it starts to get dark, one of them gets into a van and drives to a store. I've been following him in that old Chevy out front. We could probably take him then.
Abrams and David pulled into the store's lot a few moments after the van parked.
Levy, you stay in the car until we come out. You look a little out of place for around here. I'll take him after he finishes shopping. Then we can go somewhere and interrogate him.
Inside the small store, David quickly spotted the Arab at the far end of one of the aisles. David picked up a box of cereal and pretended to read the label. After a moment, he glanced up only to see the Arab staring at him. Although their eyes met only briefly, David could sense that the man was uncomfortable.
Oh no, he might have made me.
David turned and walked away, attempting to look as if he was completely uninterested. Abrams glanced up when he saw the Arab running out of the store and rushing into the van.
What's going on?
A moment later, David was running out of the store.
He made me, he called. Quick, let's go, don't lose him.
The van was squealing out of the parking lot as David climbed in and closed the door. Abrams stepped on the gas. At one corner, the van almost rolled, and the driver could barely maintain control. He sideswiped a parked car and continued. Soon they were on a straight stretch away from town. Abrams attempted to drive alongside the van to force it off the road.
Levy, he's on a cell phone talking to someone, David shouted.
The words were just out of David's mouth when the Arab swerved, making Abrams step on the brakes.
Look, Levy, the lights are beginning to flash at that railroad crossing ahead.
The 2 men could see the lights of the approaching train, but they couldn't tell how fast it was moving.
I think he's going to try to cross before the train gets there. We'll lose him if he does.
Abrams stepped on the gas pedal. The front of the van crossed the tracks just as the train hit it about midpoint. There was a tremendous crash, and the gas tank exploded. Abrams braked hard. The 2 men sat there for a moment, watching a ball of fire being shoved down the track by a long snake. They could see the train beginning to stop about 1/4 mile down the track.
Levy, we've got to get back to that shack, David exclaimed. He might have called to warn them. We mustn't let them get out of Presidio.
As they approached the shack, they could see 3 men loading a van. The lights of their car caused the Arabs to run for cover. Abrams stopped about 50 yards from the shack. Then he and David jumped out, leaving the headlights on. One of the Arabs stepped from behind the shed with a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. With a stream of yellow light, the car was blown backward in a ball of flame. Both David and Abrams drew their weapons and fired toward the shed. For a moment, there was silence. Abrams picked up an old bottle and tossed it. As soon as it hit the ground, small arms fire came from the Arabs, aimed at the sound. David and Abrams responded with a volley of shots.